WMAL News at 7, I'm Heather Curtis. One person is dead, four injured, including a Virginia Tech student, after a shooting at a hookah bar in downtown Blacksburg last night, according to police. They say someone opened fire at the Melody Hookah Bar Lounge on Main Street just before midnight. People at Virginia Tech were told to stay inside and lock their doors for a while. The president of Virginia Tech says in a statement, the school's helping with the investigation and anyone with information should call police. The Minneapolis mayor putting an immediate moratorium in place on no-knock warrants 2 days after police went into an apartment downtown and killed a 22-year-old black man.
New body cam footage released by the Minneapolis Police Department of SWAT team members fatally shooting an armed black man during a no-knock search warrant earlier this week.
That is Fox's Laura Engel. The footage shows Amir Locke wrapped in a comforter on a sofa and had a gun in his hand. Locke's parents say he reached for his legally kept gun when police startled him from a deep sleep. A Montgomery County police officer is dead after suffering a medical emergency and crashing his car yesterday. 36-year-old officer Douglas Haggerty was traveling eastbound on Spencerville Road after Good Hope Road when he got into a single car crash, according to police. A child who was in the car got out, called 911, and was taken to a hospital with minor injuries. Haggerty served in the Rockville District. Virginia Governor Glenn Youngkin says he'll appeal a decision from an Arlington judge ruling school boards can keep mask mandates in place for now.
A spokesman for the governor says the ruling is just the first step in the judicial process. Seven school systems are fighting the governor's executive order, saying parents should decide if their children should wear masks to school. In a 10-page ruling, the judge cited Senate Bill 1303, which requires school systems to offer in-person learning following CDC guidelines. The school systems behind the lawsuit say they're pleased with the ruling. Rachel Sutherland on WMAL and WMAL.com.
WMAL Sports. Tonight, the Wizards play the Suns at 7. Three-time Olympic gold medalist snowboarder Shaun White says this will not only be his last Olympics, it will mark his final contest, too. The NHL All-Star Game makes its return in Las Vegas.
After being scrapped by the COVID-19 pandemic last year, T-Mobile Arena will play host to today's NHL All-Star Showdown. The three-on-three tournament fashion continues, with the Atlantic Division All-Stars facing the Metropolitan Division. Winner of that matchup will take on the winner of the showdown between the Central Division and the 2020 champs from the Pacific Division in the finale. Edmonton Oilers captain Connor McDavid excited for his fifth All-Star appearance.
You know, there's some of the new guys coming in, you know, the Troy Terrys and whatnot. So I guess I'm excited to play with some of those young guys.
The NHL All-Star Game gets underway in Vegas at 3 p.m. Matt Napolitano, Fox News.
Traffic and weather next here on News Talk 105.9 WMAL. It's 7:05 on News Talk WMAL 105.9. Traffic and weather. Here's Albie D in the Hadid Carpet Cleaning Traffic Center.
On the BW Parkway in Prince George's County, northbound in Greenbelt, there is a crash. Lanes are blocked approaching the Beltway. They're taking traffic off at Riverdale Road. On 95, between the two Beltways, no delays, northbound or southbound between Baltimore and D.C. On the D.C. Beltway, both in Maryland and Virginia, you're at speed on the inner loop and on the outer loop. On 295, 395, and 695 in the district, that's clear. And on 66 in Fairfax County, I have no reports of any delays eastbound or westbound. And now, from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Plenty of sunshine, but very cold start to the weekend. Wind chills in the teens to the afternoon with some gusty winds. Highs today in the lower 30s. Tonight, clear skies, very cold. And the teens in the suburbs, right around the 20-degree mark downtown. Sunday, more sunshine, high temperatures approaching the 40-degree mark. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
Right now, 29 degrees in Stafford Courthouse, 29 in La Plata, and 31 degrees here in Washington under mostly cloudy skies. I'm Heather Curtis on News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Now, from the 105.9 WMAL WynnBET Studios,
the Saturday Morning Update.
It's hour two of the Saturday Morning Update on News Talk 105.9 WMAL. I'm Rick Fowler. John Gizzi joins us every week, the White House correspondent and chief political columnist at Newsmax TV and Newsmax.com. John, good morning.
Good morning, Rick.
You were on the road this week, Salt Lake City, big meeting of the Republican National Committee. What were the highlights?
Well, after 3 days in Salt Lake City, watching the 165 members of the Republican National Committee meet, we saw some new ground being broken. in a unanimous vote of the RNC's resolution committee and a voice vote of the full committee yesterday, party funds and support were denied to two Republican House members, Liz Cheney of Wyoming and Adam Kinzinger of Illinois. Now, in the past, the party has denied funding and support for members of Congress and other office holders who are involved in criminal activity. In this case, the act is not criminal, but to some in the RNC, in fact to a lot, it's completely heinous. Kinzinger and Cheney, they say, joined the January 6th commission picked by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi after their own Republican leader, Kevin McCarthy, made recommendations of other Republicans who were turned down by the House Speaker. Cheney and Kinzinger were very willing to go on the committee, and according to members of the RNC I spoke to, they had a complete disregard of due process in pursuit of the committee's goal, finding out what really happened on January 6th, and that they're being used as props by the Democrats in the House. Hence, they're not going to get any support. Sentiment at the meeting in Salt Lake City was overwhelming for doing this. Nina Weber, Republican National Committee woman from Cheney's own Wyoming, told me, "I love it." And other members freely volunteered that they'd given money to Cheney's leading opponent already. There's even talk the RNC is now in a position to back the challenger to a sitting member of Congress, something that would be unprecedented in the annals of the party history. Now, of course, there is the argument that several members made that just because you disagree with a member of Congress on one or two issues is no reason to read them out of the party. Don Tracy, the newly elected Republican state chairman of Illinois, put it succinctly, "If you want to grow a church, you don't start by excommunicating members." Clearly, the RNC disagreed. One more thing. There was only one prominent member outside the RNC to publicly disagree early with this resolution, and he denounced the idea of reading people out of the party for speaking their mind. That was Utah Senator Mitt Romney, the uncle of Republican National Chairwoman Ronald Romney McDaniel.
So Kinzinger is not running for re-election, but if Liz Cheney wins her primary, what happens then?
All right. Party rules mandates that all incumbents have the support of the Republican National Committee. But having covered RNC meetings for decades and watched them strike down resolutions directed at a certain issue or individual before, I was surprised to see this measure passed, not to mention the overwhelming support for it. I would say that the party would support her as they support all incumbent Republican House members, but who knows?
Are we hearing anything new on President Biden's potential pick for the opening at the Supreme Court?
Well, it's interesting you say that. A week ago, and I still stand by this, all sources were saying it would be U.S. District Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson of the Washington, D.C. Court of Appeals. She's been the favorite for a long time, one-time editor of Harvard Law Review, picked by Barack Obama for the district court and by Biden for the Court of Appeals, and confirmed with three Republican votes. In other words, to use a common shibboleth today, she checks all the boxes. But last week, the White House admitted it was considering Judge Michelle Childs of South Carolina, a favorite of Congressman Jim Clyburn, who himself has a close relationship with President Biden and was the pivotal figure in his winning the South Carolina primary. More significantly, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina said he would vote for his fellow resident of the Palmetto State, Childs, if she were named. Now, does this change the playing field at all? Probably not. It's more public consumption than anything. This reporter still says the president will name by the end of the month federal judge Ketanji Brown Jackson.
John, the president in New York with the new mayor of New York, Eric Adams, they were talking about the crime surge in New York. The president continuing to focus on guns, not prosecutors. Other messaging from the White House. Are you getting any sense that they're adjusting, making any adjustments to the polls yet, or still staying with the course they're on?
Certainly, the president's appearance with Mayor Eric Adams was a significant step that he's trying to move away from the Black Lives Matter and defund the cops movements. Eric Adams, who served as one of New York's finest and retired as a captain, ran as a law and order candidate. He is beloved by his fellow men and women in blue, and he speaks his mind about law and order. In addition, in total contrast to his predecessor, Bill de Blasio, Mayor Adams will firmly stand with the police. Now, this is something that Joe Biden, fairly or unfairly, has never been identified with. Clearly, in reaching out to Eric Adams and actually going to New York to be with the mayor, it sounds as though he's changing his stripes. Oh, yes, this is an election year.
A lot of controversy in the UK over the Prime Minister Boris Johnson and not exactly adhering to the COVID restrictions at the time. Tell us a little bit about what he did, and the response is getting even more intense.
2 weeks ago, when I was in London, all of the discussion from the political class as well as journalists was about what the report by senior civil servant Sue Gray would say about Boris Johnson's partying. They even called it Partygate. He made an appearance in the yard of number 10 Downing Street with other employees. They were not wearing masks, and the party, as an invitation showed, was BYOB, bring your own bottle. That's all well and good, and that fits with Boris Johnson's image as the great partying prime minister. It does not fit with the laws that he is entrusted to enforce, which are masks, minimal gatherings of people, and no partying, no dancing, no signs of revelry. All of Londoners live under it, although Johnson himself eased the rules 2 weeks ago. But it was clear when the report came out that, as one member of Parliament put it, he either did not know what the law was, a law that was enacted while he was Prime Minister, or he was blithely ignoring it to do whatever he wants. Normally, people would simply shrug and say, that's Boris. At a time when London is under a veritable lockdown and people have difficulty moving about different things, it's not that funny when someone can do what they want to do. Politically, well, as of yesterday morning, five top aides to the Prime Minister resigned. One member of his Conservative Party defected to the opposition Labour Party, and his own Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rishi Sunak, distanced himself from Johnson and criticized his response to the report, a sign he may be ready to try and win the top job himself. The lad book bets are that Boris Johnson won't make it through the year. The one thing I'd say, he surprised a lot of people over the years.
John, we heard the news this week that Senator Ben Ray Lujan, the Democrat of New Mexico, suffered a stroke. He's only 50 years old. What's the latest on his condition, and what does that mean in the Senate right now?
I talked to Steve Pierce, who's the Republican state chairman of New Mexico, two nights ago, right after the news came out that Senator Lujan was in the hospital. He's convinced that he will recover and go back to work. Other senators, notably Tim Johnson of South Dakota, have had far more severe strokes and have gone back to the job. Now, that said, there's going to be a period of time, length of it unknown, in which on a major vote, there will be 49 Democrats and 50 Republicans, which means that they don't need on the Republican side to win over senators such as Joe Manchin, who break from the Democratic hierarchy. They just need to vote every single member on a measure. What this could be, I don't know. But I'd say that in wishing Ben Ray Lujan well, a lot of senators privately voiced concern on this.
John Gizzi, White House correspondent, chief political columnist at Newsmax.com. As always, John, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure.
It is 7:18, News Talk 105.9, WMAL. We've got Cheryl Atkinson coming up next for you, but first let's head over to the WMAL Traffic Center. Al BD is there this morning.
On the BW Parkway in Prince George's County, northbound in Greenbelt, there is a crash. Lanes are blocked right at the Beltway. On the Beltway in Maryland and in Virginia, no reports of any delays on the inner loop and on the outer loop. In Virginia on 66, eastbound and westbound lanes, that's clear, no construction or crashes. 95 in Virginia, between the Beltway and Fredericksburg, that's also at speed, northbound and southbound. And in Montgomery County on 270, between the Beltway and Frederick, no delays are being reported, northbound and southbound. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Plenty of sunshine, but very cold start to the weekend. We've had some single-digit wind chills this morning. We'll continue to have chills in the teens to the afternoon with some gusty winds upwards of 30 miles per hour at times. Now, full sunshine highs today in the lower 30s. Later on tonight, we'll lose the wind. Clear skies, very cold. And the teens in the suburbs, right around the 20-degree mark downtown. For your Sunday, more sunshine, also a little bit more in the way of warmth. High temperatures approaching the 40-degree mark. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
It's 28 degrees, 7:19, the Saturday morning update on WMAL.
Know the news the minute you wake up. O'Connor and Company with Larry O'Connor, 5 to 9 a.m. on WMAL.
The Saturday morning update continues on News Talk 105.9 WMAL. It's good to have you along with us this morning. And Cheryl Atkinson is with us each week. She does great investigative journalism. You can catch her every Sunday morning, 10 o'clock on ABC 7. It's Full Measure. And Cheryl, wonderful to have you with us this morning.
Great to be here.
Throughout the pandemic, we've seen doctors, medical experts, pundits talking about every possible aspect of COVID-19, often making projections, sometimes sensational. But tomorrow you'll talk with a doctor who has not sought the spotlight and might have a little better check on reality.
I think that's right. I mean, we started talking to him from the beginning. And I will say nobody knew at the front end of COVID who was right about the divergent things that were being said and predicted. But with the benefit of hindsight, we can now see how wrong so many public officials were about policy and advice and who was right. And a lot of these scientists that got attacked for their scientific opinions and thoughts on things, they were the ones who were right. And that includes Dr. John Dye, who's the top virologist at Fort Detrick at our biodefense research center there. They work on coronavirus. They work on the vaccines and treatments. So I went back. This is my third time, since he's got such a great track record, to talk to him about natural immunity, vaccines today, and what could be around the corner. And I really think, more so than some others we've heard from, you can take what he says to the bank. I think he's very frank and forthright.
What are some of the things he is saying, maybe about natural immunity or the vaccines, that we may not be hearing other places?
You know, he was on the front end, even though he's a big vaccine advocate, but he said these vaccines, the first ones, would not last very long or work very well. And that turned out to be the case, yet everybody acted so stunned when that happened. And he explained why. You know, these are new, novel vaccines and a technology that hasn't been successfully used for vaccination before. So we talk about that. We talk about natural immunity, which some of your listeners may know. Oddly, our top public health officials almost pretend doesn't exist for whatever reason. He talks about the power of natural immunity in addition to vaccine immunity. He doesn't act like it doesn't exist. And I asked him a really interesting question. I think you'll be interested to tune in Sunday to hear his answer. I asked him, did the Amish do it better by letting COVID just roll through in May of 2020 without any measures, no vaccines yet? They didn't shut down. They didn't mask. And some argue that's a better approach. So I got his thoughts on that, too.
Fascinating reality check on COVID-19 tomorrow morning. And another story you've got that I think's fascinating as well is The focus, of course, we see on Ukraine, and we have correspondents who are there, and they may have just gotten there recently. They may be beefing up on Ukraine, but may not have, you know, a lengthy experience or a background on it, except for what they've picked up recently. You actually talked to a war correspondent who is a resident of Ukraine. This has got to be really interesting.
Well, yeah, you know, what I miss a lot in national, international coverage on national news outlets, including when I worked, you know, at CBS and CNN, sometimes we're not very good at giving some big picture and explanations. So people know there's something going on between Ukraine and Russia, but I'll bet they don't exactly know what. They don't know geographically what it looks like over there. So I asked Nolan Peterson, who's a former U.S. Special Operations pilot, by the way, and is a journalist. He's living in Ukraine. He's married a Ukrainian woman. He's reported from there for a long time. I asked him to tell us what's really going on the ground. And so he gives us his sense of what they're expecting in terms of a potential Russian invasion. And, Rick, I thought one of the most interesting things he said was they're doing training of ordinary civilians and families on how to take up arms and fight the Russians if it becomes necessary. And he says they will do that in Ukraine. So he's got video of some of that that you'll also see on Sunday.
President Zelensky has kind of tried to play things down a little bit in terms of the intensity. He's seen it as a problem for business for his country. Did you get any sense of how intense things are in Ukraine?
Well, I did. That's one thing I wanted Nolan to talk about, because you hear some people say this is all very overblown. You hear others say it's super imminent and dangerous. And he said, you'll have to hear his words, but my take on what he was telling me was maybe a little while ago people were not that concerned, but he said there's been a change. And at least in the capital of Kiev where he is, there is a sense that something fairly imminent is bound to happen. And he says people are at the decision-making stage right now. Do we go and try to evacuate somewhere now or risk getting caught, perhaps surrounded in the capital? You know, where they can't get out if something happens, because there could well be an attack that involves, you know, the Capitol. So I think he gives a really good sense of what the people on the ground are thinking may be coming.
Well, that's all tomorrow morning, ABC 7, 10 o'clock. It's Full Measure with Cheryl Atkinson. And as always, Cheryl, thank you very much.
Thank you. Have a great weekend.
And you too. It is 7:25. This is the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL. Coming up, we've got Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer and KT McFarland's on the way as well. Saturday Morning Update, 7:28, News Talk 105.9 WMAL. Well, we all know Chuck Schumer, the Senate Majority Leader, the man that never met a camera he didn't like. Well, he kind of stepped in it on Thursday. Sizable error. Here's what he did. He claimed that the Supreme Court was made up of all white men before 1981. Of course, 81 is when Ronald Reagan appointed Sandra Day O'Connor as the first woman to join the high bench. Well, Schumer's claim about all white men prior to 1981 was wrong. He did forget something very significant. Thurgood Marshall, who argued several cases before the Supreme Court, winning the famous decision in Brown versus Board of Education before Lyndon Johnson nominated him to be the first black justice. Marshall spent 24 years on the Supreme Court before he retired in 1991. He was replaced by Clarence Thomas, the second African-American to become a Supreme Court justice. Schumer later copped to his error, and he tweeted that he misspoke. By that time, however, dozens of social media users had emphatically reminded him of his mistake. You remember Keith Olbermann? And he was quite the liberal pundit in the day. Well, here's what he tweeted. 3 hours since Schumer made the egregious, silly mistake, apparently ad-libbed, forgetting Justice Thurgood Marshall during Black History Month, and no correction from him or his staff. Olbermann posted that about a half an hour before Schumer did tweet his apology. Okay. 7:30 news is next. Then it's Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer and KT McFarland on the Saturday Morning Update.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington, a Cumulus Media station.
Making sense of the news.
News Talk 105.9.
News now.
WMAL News at 7:30. Good morning. I'm Heather Curtis. A shooting at a hookah bar in downtown Blacksburg last night leaves one person dead and four injured, including a Virginia Tech student. It happened just before midnight. It's being investigated as a homicide. The town of Blacksburg says it doesn't know the condition of the four people who were taken to hospitals. People of Virginia Tech were told to shelter in place for a time. No word on whether anyone's been arrested. The president of Virginia Tech says in a statement, things like this are difficult and unsettling for everyone, and help is available for students and employees. Another shooting last night at a church in Aurora, Colorado. One person was killed and two others injured after a man opened fire.
Cops say that suspect fled after the shots. It happened at the Iglesia Faro de Luz Church with numerous people inside at the time. Aurora Police Agent Matthew Longshore.
There is a relationship. It wasn't just a random shooting inside this church. There is some sort of relationship between one of the victims and the suspect.
Longshore says the other two shooting victims were transported to the hospital and are expected to survive. Cops say they interviewed several witnesses at the church. Rob Dawson, Fox News.
Virginia Democrats applauding a decision from an Arlington County judge who issued a temporary injunction on Governor Glenn Youngkin's executive order saying parents should decide whether their kids should wear masks to school.
A spokesman for the governor says an appeal is in the works, adding more voices, including from the scientific and medical community, calling to question the efficacy behind a mask mandate for children. In a statement, Virginia's Democrat Party chair accused Youngkin of using children as political pawns. Seven school systems went to court, arguing Virginia law requires school boards to hold in-person classes following CDC guidelines. Rachel Sutherland on WMAL and WMAL.com.
A Montgomery County police officer died after crashing his car yesterday morning while having some kind of medical emergency. It happened as 36-year-old officer Douglas Haggerty was driving eastbound on Spencerville Road. A child who was in the car was taken to the hospital with minor injuries. WMAL Sports, tonight the Wizards play the Suns. Traffic and weather next on News Talk 105.9 WMAL. WMAL Traffic and Weather. Here's Albie D in the Hadid Carpet Cleaning Traffic Center.
In Maryland on the Beltway, specifically in Bethesda, there is an accident on the outer loop of the Beltway approaching River Road. That's the only delay on the Maryland side of the Beltway, both in Prince George's County and in Montgomery County. In Prince George's County on the BW Parkway northbound, there is a crash in Greenbelt. Two lanes are blocked right at the Beltway. On 50 in Prince George's County, between the Beltway and the Bay Bridge, no delays are being reported eastbound and westbound. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Today, mostly sunny, a high near 33, but it will feel like the teens with wind chills. Right now, 31 degrees in Washington. I'm Heather Curtis on WMAL News Talk 105.9.
7:36. This is the Saturday morning update on WMAL. I'm Rick Fowler. Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer joins us. He is the author of Operation Dark Heart. He is the president of the London Center for Policy Research, also the co-host of the Thought to Action podcast at London Center. Tony, good morning. Great to have you with us.
Always great to join you, Rick. Thanks for having me.
Well, we've been watching the story, Ukraine, Russia, the U.S. It's been developing for weeks now. You put it all in perspective in an editorial, and it ran in the Washington Times this week. The headline on it, How Biden Learned to Love Russian Aggression. Please explain that to us.
Well, for the most part, to put the bottom line up front, he's taking advantage of the activities there for purposes of, I believe, throwing us off the focus of what's going on here in the United States. He's using essentially the very long drawn out game with Putin to distract from his own, you know, economic and other failures here at home. But when you go a level deeper then, you recognize, Rick, and I go through factually and lay out the case how this policy, the policy regarding Putin, regarding Ukraine, has been a mess since the Obama administration, since they allowed Crimea to be annexed by Putin. They did absolutely nothing after that back in 2014. And the series of missteps and other, I want to say almost like they knew that what Putin was doing, and they didn't really do anything to stop him anyway. You cannot take the current policy that Biden puts forth seriously, because it's like they've purposely thrown the game every step of the way. They're always reacting to Putin, and that's one of the things I actually said. It's like, if you really want to do these things, if you really want to deter the Russians, these are the things you should have done a year ago. And the other thing that Biden continues to do, and maybe it is something that he wants to do, is he reacts to Putin. He's always one step behind. The other thing, if you really wanted to be aggressive in stopping the Russians, then stop playing Putin's game. Develop your own strategy and your own plans to establish a real effort to counter him, because what they've done and what they're doing is not going to work. So that's kind of the summary of what I said.
Well, you mentioned kind of develop a plan and all. It sort of reminds me of the leading from behind criticism that used to be levied at the Obama administration and Joe Biden, obviously, as the vice president. You make an interesting note in the opinion piece. You said there is no reason to believe that they, Team Obama 2.0, will behave differently this time than last. Tell us a little bit about Team Obama 2.0, because so many of the Obama administration officials are basically running this administration.
It comes from a comment that came from Ned Price, who was mixing it up with a reporter this week about this very issue, with the AP reporter. Ned Price was asked, the State Department spokesman, hey, why should we believe anything you all do different, anything you guys will do different this time, you know, regarding Crimea and what they failed to do last time? And Ned Price said, oh, no, we're going to take it more seriously. You're like, really? I haven't seen that. And so I think that's a valid question. And I think, you have the same people doing the same thing. You're not going to get a different result. Just saying.
You also talk in the editorial about the relationship with NATO and perhaps a different path we could have taken with NATO.
We should take still. Look, I believe NATO has outlived its usefulness. President Trump started down that path but didn't go far enough. Rick, there is a purpose for NATO, but being antagonistic to the Russians is not helpful. And, you know, the first thing they have to do is recognize that since the Tsar Alexander III in the 19th century, they've always had this paranoia, somewhat justified, that they need to have these states around them, which are essentially a buffer from the outside. They're not going to change. So why don't we find a way to cooperate on terrorism, energy, issues that relate to collective security? These are all things that would be useful and, frankly, probably something that would deter aggression by the fact you have a cooperation in place. And that would require strategy and somewhat of a nuanced new thing initiative that the Biden administration doesn't seem to be able to share.
There were reports this week and satellite images shown on the news channels of an apparent continued buildup of Russian troops at the border. What do you make of that, with all of the pressure that the Biden administration has attempted to put on Putin, that they're still apparently building up the troops?
I believe the Russians still are up to no good. I mean, despite the fact I'm kind of defending some of this, I'm defending only the fact that the Biden administration has misread things and not taken advantage of opportunities. Putin's a bad guy. Putin has intent to do what he feels necessary to secure their interests. So, Rick, I still don't believe it's impossible for the Russians to do something aggressive, to take part of Ukraine. As a matter of fact, I still think it's very possible. I don't think they're going to do it the way this administration thinks they're going to do it.
All right. Want to turn to some big news out of the administration this week. And we took out the leader of ISIS. And you, as a former senior intelligence operations officer, tell us a little bit about what went into the preparations on that. How long does it take? And you know, the detail you have to go through, because that's obviously very, very dangerous work.
Well, we actually devote about two chapters to these sorts of things in Operation Dark Heart, if people want to read in detail. What you need to do in a case like this is obviously develop credible intelligence down to the level of detail of where an individual or group of individuals are living. And that takes a lot of time. it takes a full spectrum of collection. It is SIGINT, signals intelligence coming from phones and things like that. Imagery intelligence, obviously, you've seen the pictures of the compound. And obviously, and the most important thing in my judgment, since I was a case officer, is human intelligence. You need to have a clear understanding of where individuals are at if they're going to do it with precision to prevent catastrophic failure, like getting the wrong house, or collateral damage, where in this case, unfortunately, there were women and children killed. And so I think in many cases, like the bin Laden raid of Neptune Spear, there was a great deal of very specific intelligence which was used effectively. One of the things that's being questioned right now is what really happened. It's been interesting, Rick, that the Biden administration's narratives on Ukraine and this false flag they were proposing and now on this are all being questioned. Did it really happen the way it happened? And in this case, like the case of Ukraine, they've not presented any definitive intelligence saying this is the way it happened. And right now there's questions because a number of women and children were killed. This guy they got was bad. This guy, this ISIS guy, was the guy who orchestrated the attack against the Yazidi. He was a really bad guy, and he was planning additional terror acts from what I've been able to figure out what he was doing. With that said, I'll be curious to see how much real intelligence this administration can show to demonstrate that what they did was justified, which I believe it was, but if the method that they used or the timing they used was could have been better by the fact that they had a lot of collateral damage in this case.
You know, it's one thing when conservative media outlets will criticize the administration in a situation like this, but I noticed that some of the White House reporters and State Department reporters, Pentagon reporters, were looking at this very skeptically as well this week. It's not just coming out of conservative media.
Well, that's the important thing, and I think this is the way it should be. Everybody should be questioning, like, okay, you know, there's been incidents in the past where presidents have, you know, wanted to have the intelligence out there. JFK put out imagery intelligence via Adlai Stevenson of the UN back in 1962 to show the Russian-Cuban missile crisis was going on. Ronald Reagan presented very detailed signals intelligence in the 80s for the KLM, the Korean Airlines 007 flight being downed by the Soviets. So there are cases where clear intelligence is presented to justify an action. There's no reason that this administration couldn't do that here, which then creates doubt, and that's why you see both sides of the aisle questioning the narrative at this point in time.
And what impact do you think this has on ISIS? I know typically when you have a situation where a leader's taken out, they just put another leader in. Any difference this time around?
Well, they're getting lower on the number of leaders left. This guy was not up there at the top, and it took some time to get him in place. Apparently, he was very passive. Everything I've read about the guy, he, like, set out no policies. He was like a ghost. So the fact is the next guy knows he's going to be hunted down. So they are every day diminishing. With that said, I think you're going to see attempts globally, very remote places, for them to kind of try to regain some level of momentum. But for the most part, Rick, the concerted effort by DOD to continue to keep after these folks has been very effective. I'd like to believe that we're going to see, we've not seen the last of ISIS, but it's going to be harder and harder to find guys to lead it.
So you're saying there's not a lot of great talent in the bullpen, huh?
Yeah, I think they're all, you know, as a matter of fact, I would say something right now that would give me a lot of trouble regarding the Biden administration, but I won't say that.
Well, they did take him out, so we'll give him that. Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer, Thought to Action Podcast, what's up this week?
So we've been talking more about human trafficking. We have someone who wrote a book called Voices Against Human Trafficking. We go through and talk in great detail about those issues. That's one of the things we're doing. Plus, we have Chris Farrell from Judicial Watch joins me on Thought to Action for a special Thought to Action. He's the Director of Investigations at Judicial Watch. We talk about a FOIA they submitted 14 years ago for an operation I was a part of called Able Danger. Now, somehow the Special Operations Command has been dragging their feet, giving them information. Who would have thought? So we talk about that in a great deal of detail regarding something called Able Danger and this operation that I was involved in.
Cool. Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer. Find out more at londoncenter.org. Tony, thank you.
Thank you.
7:47, Saturday Morning Updates, WMAL. We'll talk with KT McFarland next, but first to Albie D in the WMAL Traffic Center.
On the Maryland side of the Beltway in Montgomery County, there is an accident reported in Bethesda on the outer loop of the Beltway at River Road. In Prince George's County on the BW Parkway northbound in Greenbelt, there is a crash. All lanes are blocked right now at the Beltway. On Route 50 in Prince George's County between the Beltway and the Bay Bridge, no delays eastbound and westbound. 270 in Montgomery County is clear, northbound and southbound. And in D.C., 295, 395, and 695. I don't have any reports of any crashes or construction to slow you down. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Plenty of sunshine, but very cold start to the weekend. We've had some single-digit wind chills this morning. We'll continue to have chills in the teens to the afternoon with some gusty winds upwards of 30 miles per hour at times. Now, full sunshine highs today in the lower 30s. Later on tonight, we'll lose the wind. Clear skies, very cold in the teens in the suburbs, right around the 20-degree mark downtown. For your Sunday, more sunshine, also a little bit more in the way of warmth. High temperatures approaching the 40-degree mark. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
28 degrees in the nation's capital, 7:48 on WMAL. 7:50, the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL. I'm Rick Fowler. Every week we are joined by KT McFarland. She is the author of Revolution, Trump, Washington, and We the People. And she was President Trump's first Deputy National Security Advisor. KT, good morning.
Good morning, Rick.
Well, you have written a Fox News opinion piece, and, you know, the neat thing about having you on the show is we spend so much of the show talking about what is going on right this minute, week to week, you know, what's happening on Saturday morning. Often when we talk with you, we get to kind of step back and look at the big picture. And the headline on your opinion piece, Ukraine-Russia standoff, a global crisis, the world could look very different a year from now. Tell us how this might play out.
Well, you know, as you point out, everybody's focused on, ooh, is Russia going to invade Ukraine? What's going to happen then? I think it's the Ukraine crisis is more like a worldwide Rorschach test, you know, with that ink blot and one person saw a butterfly and another person saw an atom bomb. It reveals your innermost thoughts and desires. And given America's now weakness, perceived decline under President Biden, and China and Russia's new assertiveness, those ink blots have changed dramatically from just a year ago. You know, allies no longer trust us, adversaries emboldened, friend and foe alike, or they're reassessing their interests and their ambitions accordingly. So those ink blots are changing, and they could be in a very different place a year from now. So I think right now we have a lot of questions, very few guaranteed answers. You know, Russia obviously wants to bring Ukraine back under its historic control by intimidation, force if necessary. It's part of Putin's lifelong ambition. There's no secret there. He's also using it to drive a wedge between NATO members. He wants NATO to pledge they're never going to allow Ukraine to join. Well, Ukraine wants its independence, wants to join NATO. And so far, the Ukrainian military and people, they seem willing to fight for those goals, even against extraordinary odds. You know, the U.S., well, we want Ukraine independent, too, and we're going to send weapons to the Ukrainians to defend themselves by themselves. But when President Biden threatens sanctions if Russian tanks move across the border, you know, they're unlikely to get the rest of the world on board for crippling sanctions. We've already sanctioned Russia. We don't trade with Russia. Other countries do, like Germany, like Britain. So Britain, for example, they want to get Ukraine out of Putin's grasp, and they double down on sending lethal weapons. But their politically embattled prime minister, it's not clear what he's going to be able to do for Ukraine. The countries which were formerly part of the Soviet Union, now NATO members, they worry that if Russia does succeed with Ukraine, well, they're next. And they expect the alliance partners, you know, Germany, France, United States, Britain, to honor the NATO treaty obligations and come to their aid if they're attacked. But they're not 100% sure that's going to work. Now, the Germans, and they're the key to all of this, the Germans depend on Russian oil and gas to heat their homes, power their cars, and run their factories. Germany is currently in the midst of a major energy crisis. Prices have doubled and in some cases tripled. And the Germans have made it really clear that they're not going to risk jeopardizing their relationship with Russia over Ukraine. France, well, they're kind of go along with the Germans, and they're not unlikely to do much to help. So China now, though, has, and this is the important part again, China's now weighed in. They're siding with their brand-new strategic partner, Russia. China says, well, Russia has a right to reclaim territories that were once part of Greater Russia, echoing China's own claims over Taiwan. So while everybody looks at this and the current state of play, I want to look ahead. I think Ukraine is potentially about the reconfiguration of the world, that the tectonic plates of geopolitics are shifting, and nobody's sure where it's going to be. So let's say, for example, Putin demands the rollback of NATO. And what if he gets it? What if he gets Putin get everybody to sort of step back from Ukraine? He takes Ukraine however he does that, by coup, whatever. And then what does he do next? Does he then try to fight against and grab back the Baltic states? They're small. They're kind of insignificant. They're right on Russia's border. They're historically part of Russia. But they're also members of NATO. So does NATO come to their aid if they're next? And if so, what happens to a strengthened NATO? What happens to Putin? What happens if Germany and others say, well, let's go look at that Article 5 and see if it really forces us to do anything? Meanwhile, Germany can take the Baltic states in 24 hours. I've been to that corridor. It's called the Suwalki Corridor, and it slices the Baltics off from the rest of Europe. What happens if the Ukrainians fight? It could get really messy for Putin. It could be a protracted battle with a lot of civilian casualties. Might it not strengthen NATO and sort of get them to say, well, we're going to work together now, rather than divide them, which is what's Putin's goal? With so many interests at play, I'm worried that the outcome of this could be a new China-Russia alliance, a weakened NATO, and a weakened and isolated United States. And that would be just the worst of all possible worlds a year from now.
What can we do about it? I mean, you're looking down the road a year. We have a lot of people in Washington in very high places on the Hill and even in the administration that listen to WMAO. What message would you give them to avert what you see as a potential crisis?
Well, the part of the problem in government, and particularly in the West Wing of the White House, is you look at today's headline of today's crisis, and it's very difficult to look ahead at what the unexpected consequences of your actions. And it's also very hard to look ahead to see how can you position yourself now so that you're in a good place a year from now. The Chinese are very, very good at that kind of strategic positioning. And Vladimir Putin has shown that he, too, is very good at it. When he wrote his dissertation, after the Soviet Union collapsed, he was a KGB agent. He was part of the agitation and propaganda unit. When the KGB collapsed, Soviet Union collapsed, he said it was a great tragedy for the world. He went to grad school, he wrote a thesis, and he said Russia can be great again by using its natural resources, its oil and natural gas, consolidate them under government control. The prices of oil might be low now, but they'll eventually go up, and then Russia can use those revenues from exporting energy to build its military, its society, etc. But it can also use that for leverage against Europe. Ronald Reagan warned Margaret Thatcher of the same thing in the 1980s. He said, if you Europeans get dependent upon Russian oil and gas, they'll have all the political leverage. So what does the United States do now that Russia does have all that political leverage? Turn the American energy industry back on. You know, Providence gave us unbelievable oil and natural gas resources. Our genius engineers figured out how to get them out of shale rock. We could be the new energy super area to feed the whole world all the energy it needs. We should immediately work with the Europeans to build up the existing liquefied natural gas terminals in Belgium, and then we should replace Russia as the main energy supplier to Europe. Then we've got all the leverage back where we need it. And in addition, guess which country needs to import energy more than any other country in the world? China. We would be in a terrific position to have energy, American energy, exported to China.
Well, there's the plan. There's the strategy. K.T. McFarland, and again, the opinion piece at foxnews.com, Ukraine-Russia standoff, a global crisis. The world could look very different a year from now. K.T. McFarland, author of Revolution, Trump, Washington, and We the People. Thank you so much, KT.
Thank you, Rick.
That's it for the Saturday Morning Update. Thank you for being with us. Garden Sense follows the news next on WMAL.
WMALFM, Woodbridge, Washington, a Cumulus Media station.
Making sense of the news.
News Talk 105.9.